And now it's time for Power of Prophecy with your host, former professor at the University of Texas at Austin, career United States Air Force officer, and best-selling author, Tex Mars.
Hello, friends. This is Tex Mars. Welcome to another edition of Power of Prophecy. Well, we're going to be talking today about the World War II, the post-World War II period. Now, you may think this is not important to you, but it really is. Because events were in place at that time, and things were put into action which involve us to this day in a big, big way. Now, let me lead you into the discussion by letting you know what I'm going to talk about today is the destruction of both Germany and Japan by the United States with Britain's help, but generally the United States. The destruction of Germany and Japan and what happened after that destruction, after the war, after the two nations surrendered. And I want to assure you that what you'll hear today is not what the news told us at the time. You know, I was recently reading a book called The Iron Curtain Over America by John Beatty. It's written many years ago. And Mr. Beatty points out that immediately after World War II, the United States, for what seemed to be inexplicable reasons at the time, hired many hundreds of propagandists called public relations personnel to go to Europe and also Japan, but especially to Germany and other places in Europe, and to work on certain projects. Now, you would think that we were reserving all of the money and our wealth into rebuilding Europe. That's what we were told. But what need of there was all of these public relations personnel, propagandists? It was, dear friends, in fact, the necessary reason for this was that American people were to be told the most monstrous of lies about what was taking place in Europe. Because in defeating Germany, it was determined by the first the Roosevelt and then the Truman administration of Harry S. Truman that it was not enough to simply accept the unconditional surrender of these two great powers, but we were to, once they were disarmed by our troops, then would begin a series of punishments. Collective punishments, whether the people were guilty of anything at all or not. There were a series of collective punishments to be meted out. Now, Harry Truman knew of this. All of his aides discussed it frequently. And they had to cover it up from the American people. Because here's the message that you and I were getting at the time. And I remember this as a young boy reading in the newspapers at the time. First of all, we were told that America was a compassionate and kind nation. And that even though the evil Nazis were defeated, even though they had done such horrible things, we nevertheless took care of them. Their country was destroyed, but we went in with all of our money and power and might and rebuilt it again. That even though they did not have any crops or food, that we fed the Germans. We fed all of the peoples of Europe. And consequently, they were well off because of us. And this situation that making America look good continued all the way through the Berlin airlift of 1951 to 53. It was said that there again, we were helping to feed Berlin. It was in the Soviet sector, but we continually sent our aircraft in the Berlin airlift with goods and food to make sure the people were taken care of. Even though they were our enemies in World War II, when they surrendered in 1945, America did not seek retribution. We did not seek reparations. No, we were a kind and loving Christian nation which sought only to heal, which sought to help the people to accept a democratic republic of Germany. It was our mission to teach Germany the value of freedom. After surviving the years under Hitler and the dictatorial Nazis, America was to show them what a great nation we were, that we had a constitution and a Bill of Rights. They were to receive the same benefits of freedom. And all we could read about at the time was all the kind Americans and how they would come upon all of these poor, downtrodden German people, how we would feed them and take them in and care for them and so forth. We helped to rebuild Germany. And so today there is a very plush and luxurious nation of Germany, now one of the most powerful nations on earth, all because of America. That's what we were taught. The same thing in Japan. Even though Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor and shown its aggressive instincts throughout the Far East, once we had defeated them by bombing them with two nuclear bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, then General MacArthur went in and pacified the people. We showed them the benefits of a democracy, of freedom. And so today, Japan is one of the most powerful nations on earth. And all it seeks is peaceful capitalistic aims and purposes. In Germany, it was, of course, Eisenhower. And Eisenhower was a kind, genial man who sought only to help, who did not seek revenge at all. No, no. He was like the kind general who had massacred millions, but now with the war's end and peace at hand, we reached out through General Eisenhower only a helping hand for the Germans. Now, this was the lie that was pitched to the American people and to me personally by the politicians. And frankly, many of the politicians themselves did not know what had been decided about Germany and Japan, but particularly Germany. You see, the Jews control the Roosevelt and Truman administrations. In the Truman administration, there were two powerful Jews working behind the scenes. One was the financier, Bernard Baruch, the New York financier. The other was Hans Morgenthau. Hans Morgenthau. Now, Truman accepted the Morgenthau plan. If you want to know more about this, then go to your computer and Google up the term the Morgenthau plan. I don't think you'll get all the proof that you should and deserve to get there, but you will see that it was a horrible, terrible, satanic plan to punish the Germans. And it resulted by 1951 or 52, 6 or 7 years after the war, in great misery in great destruction, continuing destruction, throughout the nation of Germany. The war did not end for Germany in 1945, but the victors, the United States and Britain, and particularly the United States, because Britain did not go along with the Morgenthau Plan. The British resisted, but said nothing publicly about it. They did not want to have a row with powerful United States of America, so they kept quiet about it. But Truman himself, no one really knows how he felt, but we do know about Eisenhower. Eisenhower hated the Germans, and he was glad to see them receiving what he thought was their just punishment. Now, there were a few heroes at the time. One was General Patton. As gruff and effective a war commander as he was, General Patton was generous in peace. And his part of Germany that he controlled, he sought to bring peace and honor, to feed the people, to bring them liberty. But he saw what was being forced, he was being forced to do by Eisenhower, who was the reigning governor, let's just say, of Germany. He did not like the things that he was told to do, George Patton. He wrote back to his wife of the misery he was forced to inflict on peaceful Germans. Men, women, children who had no part in the war. And if he did not inflict it, he was accused of being lax. He planned to come back to America and tell the American people what was really happening. This was the plan of George Patton, General Patton, the famous and successful George Patton. But unfortunately, he did not make it back to America. He was, we know now, murdered. Yes, he was murdered. First, his Jeep, his vehicle, was hit by a truck. And then, laying there wounded on the road, he was picked up and taken to a hospital. But before he could get there, they had planned to kill him for sure if they didn't kill him the first time. And he was run into again. He had two accidents. One on the way to the hospital. There he was in the hospital in horrible agony and pain. It was thought that his only way of living could be if he were shipped back to the United States. That's what he wanted to be, to happen to him. He told his aides, "Let me go back to the United States. There, I can be worked on by doctors." But here, he knew, here in Germany, I will not get out alive. Well, he didn't get out alive. He died in the hospital. Another hero was the Secretary of War, our first Secretary of Defense, James Forrestal. Forrestal saw what was really going on, that the Jews had control of the American government. And they were dictating to President Truman what must be done to punish Germany. He did not go along with this at all. And he sought to do something about it. But realizing what was happening, he was arrested and taken and put in the military hospital in Washington, D.C. And it was said that he was having a nervous breakdown. On the day he was to be released from the hospital, he decided, quote unquote, to jump out the window and kill himself on the pavement below. So Forrestal jumped out the window. Now I can show you the facts about that he did not voluntarily jump. but was, let's just say, encouraged to jump. But our Secretary of Defense was murdered. We didn't have the internet in those days. There was nobody named Tex Mars to tell the Americans this, what was going on. Everybody believed the same thing. We didn't have TV, or it was in its rudimentary stages. We had the radio, the radio networks owned by Jews, the newspapers owned by Jews, and they told us what they thought we should hear. You say, but Tex, we had millions of troops over in Europe. They knew what was going on. No, they didn't. They were doing their jobs. They were guarding camps. They were typing things. You know, they were practicing in their tanks, rehearsing all kinds of things that military people do on a day-to-day basis. But they were not in leadership positions, and they could not see the big picture and know what was really going on. I remember discussing many years after the war what had happened in Germany with a good friend of mine named Hans Schmidt. Now, Hans Schmidt had been a young man of 16 years of age when he was pressured into entering the German armed forces. Now, think, 16 years of age, but they needed troops. The Americans were inside their borders, and so were the other, the Russians were knocking on the door, and the French, and so, you know, all of the, Germany was collapsing, and they used every, they went all the way down to 12 years of age. I mean, the guy didn't even go to boot camp or basic training. They just threw him a weapon and a uniform and said, here, you're in the army. Fight against the Americans and so forth. He was only in the army for a couple of months. And then his entire unit was forced to surrender to the Americans. And the Germans who surrendered said, well, we've lost the war, but thank God we were surrendering to the Americans. They're good people. They'll take care of us. And after all, we took care of the American POWs in World War II. We fed them. We sheltered them. We gave them heated barracks to live in. They'll do that for us for a couple of months till we're all processed out. Then we'll go out as civilians and go back to our families. Have to rebuild broken down, destroyed Germany again. It wasn't to be so. One day, Hans Schmidt, he saw horrible things there in the camp, by the way, and the soldiers were dying. They were dying. One after another were dying. What of? Lack of food. Lack of shelter. It was bitter cold, you see. And they were offered no heat at all. They lived out in the open. They had no tents. They slept on the ground. They tried to dig holes and hide in the holes from the harsh weather elements. Hans told me that in 1 month, out of 100,000 approximately soldiers that were POWs, 25,000 died. 25,000 died. At that rate, in 3 more months, there would be none left. Then one day, Hans, suffering, cold, damp, shaking because of all the cold, he heard his name called, Hans Schmidt. Report to Captain so-and-so. Frightened and yet surprised, he went in and he went before a army captain, the United States Army captain. He stood before his desk and Hans, you know, saluted as sharply as he could. He really didn't know how to salute even. He says, what is your name, soldier? Hans said, I'm Hans Schmidt, sir. in German. The army captain said, "What unit were you with?" And Hans told him, "I was with the 4th Regiment, such and such." And he looked, and on the captain's desk was his a dossier, a folder about him. The captain said, no, you're mistaken. You were not with that unit, were you?" And Hans Schmidt said, "No, sir, I was with that unit." And the captain looked at him, put his arms down and said, Soldier Schmidt, look in my eyes." Hans Schmidt looked right in his eyes. He said, "You were not with that unit, were you, Schmidt? That unit must stay here as prisoners of war. You were with," and then he told him some other unit. "That unit is to be released next week. That's the unit you were in. Is that not right, Schmidt?" And it all came to Schmidt, as young as he was. "He's saving my life. This American captain is saving my life. I am meant to die. All the people in my unit are all meant to die. For some reason, they were all chosen to die. And this man, because of my age, because, you know, he was a very slight guy. He was very short, by the way. Probably weighed no more than 100 pounds. He had some kind of sympathy. He had seen me somewhere in the camp, and he determined I was going to live. And then it all hit me at once, the magnitude of what was going on. And I quickly snapped to, and I said, "Yes, sir, I'm of that camp, the one that was to be freed. I'm that camp. I'm not of the 4th Regiment whatsoever." "That's what I thought," said the captain. And he looked at me, and a small smile creased across his face. "You're dismissed, Schmidt." And he left. And approximately a week later, Schmidt was released. He was with the other group. He said not one person of his original contingent, his original group, got out alive. They were all POWs. They had no weapons. They wanted peace. They wanted to go home. They never wanted in the military, many of them. They'd been drafted just like Americans are. They ended up dead. Now, Hans Schmidt's case was not unusual. By the way, after the war, it turned out that the Russians took that area of Germany. Schmidt went home to see his home, but he found out the Russians were coming. And he and his family quickly left and fled into the American sector of Germany. Because the part of Germany, Eastern Germany, that the Russians took over, they made mincemeat of. The whole nation, the whole of East Germany, including Berlin, was raped, pillaged, destroyed. Town after town, village after village, city after city, the brutal and harsh Russians came in. They said that there was not one woman of any age from 6 to 80 that was not raped unmercifully by the Russians. Some were raped 20, 30, 40 times a night. Their brothers, their fathers, many of them were murdered. Their homes burnt down. Their food taken. Their livestock, whatever they had was taken. The troops would rush through their house and steal everything they had in the home. All of their jewelry, everything. Anything of value was taken from them. But what about the American sector? Were we so kind? I think the American captain that I've just told you about was a glorious exception to the rule. Because they had their orders, the Americans, the military, And they had the Morgenthau plan. They may not have known the name of it at the time. But the Morgenthau plan required them to kill most of Germany. I want to tell you a little bit about this Morgenthau plan that Truman signed. And it became the operating principle of post-war Germany. Now, the Jews were called displaced persons. They had been put in concentration camps. After the war, they were all released. And all of them were given housing. How were they given housing? It was taken from the Germans. Whatever town or city they went into, they went in and registered as a displaced person, a DP. And then they went out and chose the house that they wanted to live in. And our troops would go into that house and tell the Germans, get out. This is no longer your home. It belongs to this DP and his or her family. And so the Jews were able to take over all of the best housing in Germany. The displaced persons were given the best food and plenty of it. But the Germans had very little. Now, how do I know all this? I want to bring to your attention just three books that I am reading. One, an amazing book called Freedom Betrayed. Freedom Betrayed. It just came out recently, this book. It's a gigantic book. Let's see, it must be, it's over 900 pages. 900 pages. It's written by none other than former President Herbert Hoover. Its subtitle, this of Freedom Betrayed, is Herbert Hoover's Secret History of the Second World War and Its Aftermath. Now, at Stanford University in California, there is an institute called the Hoover Institute. The Hoover Institute is named after President Hoover, is supposedly a conservative think tank. There at Stanford University, they come up with, you know, standard conservative, you know, principles. Herbert Hoover wrote this book before his death, and it has been sitting for some 50 years at the Hoover Institute. Unpublished. Think of that, folks. This incredible book, over 900 pages, by our former president, Herbert Hoover, was never released for publication until now. Now, when you get back, I want to talk to you a little bit about this incredible book published by the Hoover Institution Press at Stanford University in California in 2011. 2011, many years after the death of Herbert Hoover. It is the secret history of the Second World War and its aftermath. I want to tell you a little bit of what Herbert Hoover knew. He was outraged, and he made his outrage known to President Truman. And it was because of the efforts of Herbert Hoover that most of the people of Germany were saved from death and destruction. We'll be right back after this brief message. Stay with you. Won't you? Stay with us. Excuse me. Stay with us. We'll be right back to talk about post-World War II and Germany. And we'll also get into Japan as well. This is Tex Mars. I'm with Power Prophecy. Stay with us. Hello, friends. Tex Mars here. I can tell you about my new book. It's called Robot Alchemy. Robot Alchemy. Now, it's going to be available the 1st of May, but you can order it now from our website, powerofprophecy.com, or you can call us here at the ministry, 1-800-234-9673, or you can write to us, send us your check for $35. That would be $30 for the book, Robot Alchemy. And then the $5 will be for shipping and handling, a total of $35. Now, this book has hundreds of color photos in it. It's the first book I've really done with color. It really looks sharp. I did write the book and chose the cover, so I'm proud of it, but it's a wonderful book. But it gives a message that is very important. Robots. You know, before I began writing the kind of books I'm writing now, I wrote books on robots, robotics, computers. I wrote the very first book on personal robots called The Personal Robot Book back in 1985, about 28 years ago. Well, this book updates all that, but it tells you what our federal government has been doing all these years in robotics research. Now, a drone is a robot. We've been killing people over in the Middle East with drones. Many people are worried about drones. You'll remember that Senator Rand Paul spoke for 13 hours in a filibuster on the Senate floor. Drones. There are now thousands of drones. There will be many tens of thousands. Our privacy is at stake. But there are other things that are out there too. There's a robot called the Eater. It eats all kinds of things. DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, developed the Eater robot. It doesn't need gasoline or oil for fuel. It can eat twigs and leaves and human bodies, dead bodies. Sort of reminds you of Soylent Green, the eating of people. Well, this robot can eat human beings. There's another robot called Alpha Dog. Huge robot. Four-legged. It can hike 20 miles. You have to go a long way to get that robot to wear out. There's another military robot called the Cheetah. It gallops very fast and, in fact, goes at least three times as fast as a human being. The Japanese have developed Titan Boa, after the boa constrictor, the name. A huge 50-foot long snake or serpent that they say glides through the water. How would you like to have a 50-foot long robot serpent coming after you through the water? These are all real. They're not science fiction. They're real. And I believe they're going to be used against you and I, against people in coming years. All kinds of robots. In another 15 or 20 years, you'll be able to buy a robot and it can be your sweetheart. You can have sex with it if you're, oh my, bent on that. I pray that I'll be gone and not have to worry about these kinds of things. But robots are coming to a age of singularity when they'll be more intelligent, more brilliant. Their brains will be advanced more than human beings and they will look like movie stars. I suppose. All kinds of things are happening on the robotic front, and I want to bring this. This is the first book that's ever been out there to discuss robots at war. Robots to be used by the CIA and other agencies. Robots that look exactly like people. You say that's incredible, Tex. That's just make believe. Wait till you see the robots in this book, the pictures of them. I mean, other than one of the robots, other than having the back of his head sort of caved in to put all the computer, items in there, the chips and so forth, he looks just like you and I do. He talks, he walks, he moves, just like the image of the beast in Revelation 13. In any case, I want you to have this book. It'll be one of the first ever in the whole world to get it. Robot Alchemy. The word alchemy means witchcraft, hidden, secret. What magicians do to create life out of nothing. These robots are alive. Does all this sound fantastic to you? Then you'll want the book, Robot Alchemy, to prove it, to show others. To prepare yourselves and your families for what's coming. just 10, 15, 20 years from now, or maybe tomorrow, maybe today. Okay, here's how to get the book. Go to powerofprophecy.com, and it's right there on page one, powerofprophecy.com, or you can call us 1-800-234-9673, or you can write to us at Power of Prophecy, 1708 Patterson Road, Austin, Texas, 78733. And remember, the book is $30, and that's because it's got fancy paper and a beautiful cover, and it's 240 pages long, and it's, you know, glossy like paper and all these beautiful pictures in it. I guess color costs more to produce than black and white, naturally. But you won't be sorry. You got this book. And of course, it's our large format too. It's twice as big as a regular book. You know, the kind of Tex Mars productions we put out here. Please order Robot Alchemy today. Our phone number, 1-800-234-9673. Our address, 1708 Patterson, Patterson Road, Austin, Texas, 78733. Now, I want to also mention our conference. It's coming up. Folks, you got to get here. Man, have I got the speakers for you. Wow. Susie Hupp, bless her heart, she's a Texas congresswoman. She was in our state legislature. And let me tell you, she was a big one for no gun control, the Second Amendment to the Constitution. And you know, I understand why. Both her parents were murdered. And she was there when it happened at the cafeteria in Killeen, Texas. Do you remember that, when a gunman went in with a gun and just began to shoot people at random? I don't know how many he killed there. She's going to tell you about that story. But both her father and her mother were shot in the head. At point-blank range. If only someone had had a firearm and stopped the monster. But he walked from table to table shooting people. Susie Hupp will tell you all about that. But you'll hear my namesake. Yeah. Brother Mars. Jim Mars. He's going to be there. A lot of people say, well, it's just a fake name. When Tex wants to write other books, He used the name Jim Mars. Well, you'll see, I really don't. Jim is a good guy. I think he's my cousin, actually, but he's written a lot of great books. He's going to tell you about the JFK assassination. It's the 50th anniversary. You'll want to hear from him. Boy, he's fantastic stuff. And there's Michael Hansen, who wrote The Bohemian Grove. He's going to tell us. He was there with Alex Jones. He knows. He's written the book, Bohemian Grove. He knows what the big shots do there. He went there. He saw it all. He's written a book. Let's see, Jerry. Jerry's my broadcast engineer here. Who else do we have? I can't even think of them all. Oh, Joyce. Joyce Riley. Yeah, Nurse Riley. She has her own radio show. She's going to tell you how to stay healthy in an age of food poisoning, I'm telling you. But she'll tell you how to stay healthy. She's a wonderful person. Joyce Riley, Nurse Riley. She'll be here as well. Who else have I forgotten anybody? Yeah, I get my friend Galen Ross. Yeah, Galen Ross, he wrote Who's Who of the Elite. He's got a book out, a unique perspective on the JFK assassination. Going to tell you the Texas connection. JFK was at a very interesting meeting the night before. Well, I'm not going to tell you about it. You'll hear from the horse's mouth. Now, don't go out there saying he's a horse's mouth. Galen's my good friend. He's a good guy. So I want you to hear from Galen. Of course, I'm going to be there. I'm going to talk about my new book, Robot Alchemy, and more. Robot Alchemy. And we're going to have a special mystery guest. A mystery guest. You're going to be happy. Boy, I'm just wilting thinking about all these, especially the mystery guest. But everybody's getting, we're going to have it costs $70 per person, but it's worth it. A whole day event. We have all these speakers, and Jerry here, you'll meet Jerry too. He's going to be the sort of the master of ceremonies, the host. Remember, if you went to our last conference we had in 2010, he was the host. He's a big, handsome hunk of a guy. Oh yeah, he's going to lead it all up there. He's going to give away gifts periodically. We're going to have floor gifts, or what do they call those things? Floor prizes, door prizes. Okay. Yeah, and Wanda will be there too. See, folks, that's an added benefit. Wanda will be there. Michelle here in the office. Everybody that works in our office will be at the conference. It'll be a great hotel. Listen, you're going to love it. For $70 a person, you're just going to love it. You've got to come. I want to meet you. Okay, now, we got to get on with our program here. If you want to go to this conference, if you want information about it, just call us here, 1-800-234-9673, and say, hey, tell me about that conference. And we'll send you the information. We'll get you all signed up, and we'll enlist you, and I look forward to seeing you. Now let's return to our regular program. We're talking about what happened in Germany after World War II. See, the Germans were hated by the Jews. Did you know, I have absolute proof, that the number 6 million dying in the Holocaust was approved back in 1912. 1912! They had already decided how many were going to die. They had decided on the war. And in 1933, right after Hitler was elected, yes, he was chosen, he was elected, the Zionists worldwide had meetings in which they determined they would declare war on Germany. I can show you the headlines. Headlines of newspapers. Jews declare war on Germany. So Hitler declared war on the Jews. After the war, the Jews came back to Germany and they were angry. They were so-called displaced persons. They were in charge of Germany. Amazing. I want to tell you a little bit. Let me just read from the book Iron Curtain Over America by John Beatty. Now, here's how we put these people in charge. Now, Eisenhower supposedly was sort of the nominal guy, but listen to this. Mr. Milton Katz, K-A-T-Z, a Jew, was ambassador until 1951. The two assistant secretaries of defense that oversaw Europe were Mrs. Anna Rosenberg and Mr. Marx Leva. So you got two Jews at the Defense Department overseeing all these things. Rosenberg and Leva. Katz was the ambassador. Then there were other Jews in leadership positions, such as Max Lowenthal and Benjamin Buttonweiser. Wow. They made sure that all the Nazis were arrested. And we had the Nuremberg War Crimes Trial. And they declared at Nuremberg that these Germans had gas chambers in all of these camps. But in fact, there were no gas chambers. Why did the Germans that were tried there, why did many of them get up on the stand and admit to all these things? Well, actually, they didn't get up on the stand. They were interrogated before they got up and they signed statements. And then these statements were read to the military war crimes tribunal. The statements that they had given as to the horrible crimes they had perpetrated, particularly against the Jews. And most of them were found guilty and hung. And you say, good riddance, right? But what if they didn't make those statements except under supreme evil torture? That is exactly the truth, my friends. That is incredible. There's a new book out written by a Britishman entitled, in 2012 it's published, entitled Cruel Britannia. Cruel Britannia. Did you know that all of the Germans at Nuremberg were tortured? Tortured. Some of them committed suicide in their cells. We were told later that they kept, you know, the poison in a little cylinder and they had a hollow spot in a tooth. And they took the tooth out, opened up the cylinder and took the poison and died instantly. That's how Hermann Goering and the others died. Some of the others. Not so. They were murdered. They were murdered, tortured to death by their captors. Rudolf Hess was a German camp commander at Auschwitz. He was tortured so much that he told his interrogators, I'll tell you anything you want. Just quit torturing me, please. They said, we know you kill these Jews with these gas chambers. We want you to sign a statement. I'll sign anything, he said. And friends, you would too after weeks and weeks of torture. And the horrible things they went through. Let me read to you a little bit from this book. We had an interrogation this morning, the captain said. I'm afraid the prisoners are not a pretty sight. The sergeant unbolted the first door and strode into the cell, jabbing a metal pike in front of him. Get up, you dirty bastards, he screamed. There were half a dozen men lying or half lying on the floor. Only one or two were able to pull themselves erect at once. The man nearest me, his shirt and face spattered with blood, made two attempts before he got to his knees, and then he gradually lifted to his feet. He stood with his arms stretched out in front of him, trembling violently. Come on, get up, the sergeant shouted in the next cell. A man there was lying in his blood on the floor, a massive figure with a heavy head and bedraggled beard. Why don't you kill me? Why don't you kill me? I can't stand it anymore, he said. He's been saying that all morning, the dirty bastard, the sergeant said. This was the language. This was the scene that you get from these people. Rudolf Hess admitted that he killed way more than 6 million. I forget the exact number, but it was like I killed 20 million by gas chamber. Some impossible number. That by the time they got to court and the lawyers for America and the Soviet Union, the others read it, they said, well, we can't accuse him of that. He's admitted to too many. Let's change that to 6 million. They changed it back again. Not 6 million, but to like 4 million for Auschwitz. But he, whatever amount they said, that's what they did. You can read about it in Cruel Britannia. But there have been other books too. For example, there's the book, Other Losses. Other Losses. You may want to get that book. It's a French book that's in American and in English by James Bach, B-A-C-Q-U-E. Published in 1989 in Canada. It accuses Dwight Eisenhower, as head of the American occupation of Germany, of deliberately starving to death German prisoners of war in staggering numbers. 800,000 and possibly as many as a million, writes Bach. While concentration camp inmates got barracks, bunks, food, and heat, the Germans after the war were kept in open-air pens in freezing weather, the only shelter being holes dug in the ground. Other Losses. Millions of Germans died. Let me read to you from this book that was kept secret. A book by a president, a former president of the United States. And I'll tell you, I respect Herbert Hoover a lot more after reading his book, seeing what he did. You see, the Morgenthau Plan was in full effect. And then after a few years, it had gotten so bad over there that the generals were writing secretly to the former president. They knew it did no good to write to the Truman administration or the Truman White House because the Jews there would just throw their letters in the trash. And the military generals, our own generals in charge, wrote to Herbert Hoover and said, you must help us. You're an honorable, a decent man. We have been ordered to carry out this Morgenthau plan. Please come over here and see for yourself what we're up against, what we're having to do, how the Jews are lording it over the Germans, how so many have died, men, women, children, starved to death, beaten to death. They have no coal to light their fires. Their homes are all smashed. The smithereens are in the streets. They're trying to find shelter, holes. They're in the sewers. They're everywhere they can be. Now, Truman got with Hoover, rather, President Hoover, got with Truman and said, I would like to go to Germany. I would like to see what's going on myself. Truman was, oh my goodness, he was excited about that. He was frightened. He was scared. This former president, who had been shamed by the American press and who said, yeah, he was president and he couldn't do anything about the economy. He was a worthless president, so Roosevelt came in and gave us the New Deal, and everything was bright. No, it wasn't. In 1940, 8 years after being president, President Roosevelt was a total failure. The economy was still failing. Did you know more people were unemployed in 1940 than had been unemployed in 1932? That's right, we had more unemployed under Roosevelt than we ever had under Hoover. We turned Hoover out and listened to the promises of Roosevelt, but after 8 years of socialism, America was worse than ever before. The only way he got us out of it was by starting a world war. That's the only way Roosevelt got us anything at all. But here's what Hoover did. He said, I would like to go to Germany and prepare a report for you on what I find. And Truman says, yes, yes, do that. And then Truman was frightened to death. By the way, this all ended up with Hans Morgenthau being fired as Secretary of the Treasury. He was fired. And in his memoirs, Truman doesn't say nice things about him either. But before he was fired, Truman had to do what he and Mr. Bernard Baruch told him to do. And they told him to implement this terrible Morgenthau plan. On page 795 of this book, he said, according to the policy, there have been general policies of destruction to limit the peaceful productivity under the headings of pastoral state and war potential. We were supposed to destroy the war potential of Germany. We did that. But what the Jews wanted us to do was to turn Germany into a pastoral state. That means an agricultural state. Not even agricultural. They were just supposed to be a nation that had no industry, no light industry, no heavy industry. And so we went there and we began to burn down every factory, every manufacturing plant and facility we came upon. We burned it down. We destroyed it. That left them without any jobs. And without jobs, they had no money for food. They didn't have all this Social Security and all this stuff. We went throughout the nation burning and destroying and stealing their equipment and sending it to France and to other European countries. We would dismantle an entire plant and send it to France and leave a big, if we left it at all, it was a good thing. The Russians did the same thing. The Russians, that's how they got ahead in the space program. By dismantling all the factories and taking them by train back to Russia. We did the same thing. Then we accused the Russians of doing it. He said, there's been a general policy or general policies of destruction under the heading of pastoral state and war potential. You are converting, this is Hoover's statement to Truman. You are converting Germany into a country principally agricultural and pastoral. The industries of Germany are therefore being put out of action and closed down. Oh, we were told we're bringing back the economic revitalization of this place. Oh, we're rebuilding the factories. Everything is going great over there. No, we were taking them all down. People would have to stand outside seeing the factory, the manufacturing facility destroyed by American troops. They cried. They screamed. They said, please, we need jobs. We need these things. Not for war materials. We need to make cars. We need to make tires, shoes, whatever. The ears of the Americans did not hear. He says, a new Germany, says Hoover, must be able to aspire to peace, and it must have a good food supply of at least 2,600 calories per day. Now, he says, they're getting less than 800. Folks, can you exist with 800 calories a day? That's what the average German was receiving, 800 calories a day. A high official in the Truman administration said, that's good. Give them soup for breakfast, soup for lunch, and soup for supper. Soup. 800 calories a day maximum. That's not right, says Hoover. We must quit dismantling, destroying their plants, their factories. We must bring food from America and feed these people. We must make Germany self-supporting. There must be a new economic policy. Our principle is freedom, not tyranny, said Hoover to Truman. At the invitation of Germany's Chancellor Adenauer, I read on page 803. Hoover said, I visited Germany again in 1954. The Germans wish to express their appreciation for my services in preventing starvation and advocating sane economic policies. They arranged great demonstrations in various cities, and they requested me to make 3 public addresses on the dangers of communism. When Herbert Hoover made his report, his full report in writing to Truman, Truman was frightened to death. He said, we've got to put these things in action. We've got to stop the brutal, the vicious Morgenthau plan. And they did. The Jews protested. The Jews in America went into his office and said, we wanted to keep it going. We want to keep punishing the Germans. Truman had the guts to say, no, I can't do that anymore. Basically, he had been caught. He had been exposed, not to the American people, but to Herbert Hoover. The generals over there thanked Herbert Hoover for standing up to Truman. Basically, Hoover said, if you don't do this, if you don't correct these things, Mr. Truman, I'm going to make sure you go down in history as a monster. And it was fixed. The Morgenthau plan was ended. But there's much more. Both Germany and Japan wanted to surrender. Germany would have surrendered 6-9 months before. But we said no, unconditional, unconditional. And Japan, oh my goodness. Japan begged us to surrender. They wanted to surrender. But we said unconditional. They said, can our emperor stay in power? And you can come over, you know, basically you can do whatever you want to with our country. MacArthur can. We just want to have a figurehead like England does. Roosevelt said no, no. And then, of course, Truman said no. We would not let them surrender. The Jews did not want the Japanese to surrender. The Jews said, wait until we get the atomic bomb. We'll use it on them. They wanted a demonstration of our atomic bomb. That's why they call it the Manhattan Project. It was conceived of in Manhattan, in New York City, by Bernard Baruch and others, and Morgenthau, of course. They said, let the world see a demonstration of America's nuclear power, and then we will let them surrender. And of course, immediately after the terrifying destruction in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Japanese unconditionally surrendered. At that time, they would give us anything. Please just don't send any more of those nuclear bombs. Another great book that I read, I want to pass it on to you, is called Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 to 47, by Tom Goodrich. You may want to look for that book as well. It tells the same things. This is Tex Mars. Been great being with you today. My prayer is that you'll tune in each week and discover the power of prophecy.